A question of whether the public interest is being protected, state-of-the-art nanotechnology for space, for all of you space cadets and former L5ers in the group, and then nanotechnology and the environment. And then we'll have a welcome reception and a poster session after that. Now, to talk about dendrimer technology, we have Dr. Robert Berry, who is with Dendritic Nanotechnologies, DNT.
Right.
That's your acronym?
Easiest way to say it.
I like it. Started in August of 2004. He's been involved in the technology and research field for 26 years and has been the founder of four companies and consortia to advance the use of technology and research in education. He was the chief architect in the formation of Central Michigan University Research Corporation, which focuses its efforts in two key areas, nanoscale research and in the area of predictive business intelligence. And I'm not going to go through his entire bio. I think you already get the idea that he's a distinguished teacher. Was that sufficient?
That's fine. Intro? Thank you.
And I'd like to introduce him to you.
Thank you. Well, it certainly is a pleasure to be here today. And when they first called me, they said, "Would you serve on a panel?" And I thought, sure, why not? Don't have to prepare much for that. And then a couple of weeks ago, they said, "Oh, by the way, I guess the rest of the panel backed out or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm the only victim here." But they but they said, "Would you do a talk on medical applications, you know, the foresight challenge number 6? And so I got thinking about that, and I said, okay, that fits rather well with where we're going. And without that, let me get right into it here. What I'm going to talk about today is one of the topics is ovarian cancer. And I'm going to give you a problem, kind of frame the problem in such a way that we begin to understand, I think, the promise of nanotechnology and what it can deliver. And then we're going to take a look at where we are in terms of our technology for the resolution of this. And we're going to take a look at the targeted delivery, some future research directions that we have going on, and then hopefully at the end some time for some questions. Now, you can't hardly pick up a newspaper today without seeing some new startling announcement in the area of cancer research. However, when I begin digging back into the statistics, it was a rather startling find that this is from the American Cancer Society, that while we've had a 59% reduction in heart disease since 1950, we really have not yet seen a change in the cancer mortality rate from the same time. So even though we keep hearing the new announcements all the time and the millions and billions of dollars that are spent in research, we haven't materially affected the cancer mortality rate yet. Now, let's take a look at the cancer rates for women, 1930 to 2001. Again, these statistics are from the American Cancer Society. Ovarian cancer accounts for 6% of women cancer death, and the mortality rate, which is this line right here, if you take a look at it, essentially hasn't changed in 71 years. Now, we've had some good news. If you follow the purple line, the colorectal cancer has fallen down. The breast cancer is on the decline. Lung and bronchus cancer is on the upswing. Of course, this is one of the things where women started smoking much more in the 1960s. But it really still is a shock to me that we really haven't made much progress in this area. Let's take a little deeper dive into that. In 2005, there's going to be, the estimate is that there'll be 22,220 new cases of ovarian cancer, and 16,500 deaths in 2005. What that really means is that there's one new case every 23 minutes and one mortality every 32 minutes. In other words, about the time that it takes me to give this talk, some family will experience a death and severe grief in their family. That's a sad, sad statistic. Now, what compounds us even more is that 70% of the women with common epithelial ovarian cancer are not diagnosed until the disease is in the advanced stage 3 or stage 4. We do not, at this point in time, have a good early diagnostic tool available for this disease. The current symptoms are back pain, gas, and bloating. By the time women go to their gynecologist, begin to discuss these sorts of symptoms, they do exploratory surgery, and they find out they're in stage 3. Now, in 2005, out of those 22,250 cases, 15,540 of them will be diagnosed in stage 3 or stage 4. And what that really means is the cancer's already spread to the lymphatic system or, in some cases, the liver. And what you really have is a sympathy statement. The 5-year survival rate for stage 3 or stage 4 is only 15 to 20%. And what that means is out of those 15,540, 12,432 will be dead within 5 years. However, if you can find it early enough, the 5-year survival rate for stage 1 approaches 90%. Now, where does nanotechnology fit into that thing? What we're going to talk about for a few minutes is that size makes a huge difference in our ability to provide a targeted receptor-based diagnostic and therapeutic delivery system. And it does happen at the nanoscale level. The technology that we use is something that we call dendrimers. And I'm not going to go over this in great detail, but these are polymers. And just so as you begin to understand what I'm talking about, they go in generations, G1, G2, G2, G3, G4, so forth and so on. It's a chemical synthesis process. We develop them one layer at a time. And interestingly enough, they kind of approach the nanoscale level that one generation is about G2 is 2.6 nanometers, a G3 is 3.6, a G4 is 4.6, so forth and so on. If you'll notice in here, you begin to see interior spaces inside of the spheroid, and we use that to encapsulate therapeutics. And we don't get enough space until somewhere in the G3 to the G4 range, as well as we have an ability on the outside to attach function to these functionalized surface groups. Now, what's really interesting and important about this is that this is where your small molecule pharma currently exists. This is your biology, your biological cell size, and in the nanoscale region where our dendrimers fit, G3, G4 nanometers, emulate the size of many of our human proteins and lipids and DNA. So you have a good match in terms of size. And that's really important that you begin to understand that size makes a difference. Further demonstration of that. Here are some targeted MRI diagnostics that we have done in cooperation with Eric Weiner, University of Pittsburgh, and Martin Breckfield with the National Cancer Institute. And this has been going on for about 8 years. The current state-of-the-art in contrast agents is a complex called Magnavis, gadolinium. This is a picture of a mouse with just plain Magnavis encapsulated in there. If we go to a G4, something that's about 4 nanometers in size, you begin to see blood pool properties. In other words, it stays in the vasculatory of that mouse and it lights it up rather dramatically. Now, if we change it and go up a few sizes to a generation 8, something that's about 8 nanometers, you begin to see lymphatic imaging here on both sides of the mouse. Then you can see that they're clearly not here in the plain Magnavis. And then if you drop down in G2, you light up the kidney rather than the lymphatic system or the intravasculatory system. And if you go to, we can even change the surface and see different effects. Now that's a very good demonstration of why we say size makes a large difference in terms of where these structures go. Now, we've also been able to, remember I talked about those interior void spaces, we've been able to encapsulate MagnaVis inside of these dendroid spheroids. And this is a pre-test, this is the post-test of the same complex. So what you see here is an example of stuff that is put on the surface of the denimer as well as interior in the denimer. And again, size makes a big difference. Now, our solution, coming back to the ovarian cancer imaging and therapeutic delivery, is that we use the same complex to both do a very early diagnostic and imaging of that cancer, and then we turn right around and we use the very exact same complex, put in the chemotherapy, and have a targeted therapeutic delivery system. Now, what we're basing this on is, again, this is really a series of connecting all the dots for us. Epithelial ovarian cancers overexpress folate receptors. They like folate, especially the alpha folate receptors, and they overexpress them by as much as two orders of magnitude. And for those who don't know, folate acid is really just a vitamin B, and the cells use this for cell division. Again, in cancer, you're going to see lots of cell division very, very rapidly. Therefore, they overexpress folate, the need for folic acid. Ovarian cancer, interestingly enough, is very consistent and very high in its overexpression at 90%. So what we've been able to do is to take our dendrimer complex, attach folate to the outside of this dendrimer, and also attach the MagnaVis or the gadolinium to the outside, much like I showed you in that mouse image, and put that intravenously or intraperineal, and it attaches directly to the ovarian epithelial cancer cell. And now we have the chance for a very early imaging opportunity. And what we've seen thus far is very good stability, bioavailability, good images, and a very targeted organ specificity. Our targeted images we've been able to get thus far go as small as 0.3 millimeter. And to give you a reference and a benchmark on that, currently, in talking with the medical schools, they are somewhere in the 0.5 to 1 centimeter range in terms of diagnosing early tumors. So you already see a quantum improvement on that. And we are thinking that we will get at least a 10x reduction in the amount of the contrast agent that is necessary to develop these images. Why? Because we have it concentrated around the spheroid. It's not a small molecule that we're just dumping into your bloodstream and let float around hoping that it finds something. Now, then the other half of that, great, we can find it early. It's small enough at 3 or 4 nanometers to go through the lesions and the folds in the epithelial layer. Now what we need to do is then come back and say, great, let us deliver the chemotherapy to it. And so here you see the same dendrimer complex, except now that we have loaded internally the chemotherapies of choice. Currently, we've been able to demonstrate loadings in cisplatin, carboplatin, paclitaxel. Carboplatin and paclitaxel are the two chemotherapies of choice for this indication at this time. Cisplatin would be, but by itself it's very toxic and it's not water soluble. But by encapsulating it, we do and have control over the solubility and the toxicity of this complex. Let me show you. What we are demonstrating here is our dendrimer encapsulated cisplatin. And what we have is real good control over the release profile. As you can see, that you get an initial burst of cisplatin somewhere between 5 to 10% of the weight, and then a sustained release over several hours of this. And what we're able to do is put in 28 molecules of cisplatin or 19 molecules of cisplatin inside of this dendrimer. It's not covalently attached, it's just inside of it. And then we've also tested this in PBS, and still maintain those same release profiles. Now, by doing this, we also change the therapeutic properties. What I said, cisplatin by itself is not soluble in water. It is very toxic. And when we've encapsulated it, the dendrimer, the outside, makes it water-soluble. And we've also been able to see a 5x increase in the therapy delivered to the tumor while the concentration of the cisplatin has been held constant. Now, and that's right here. You see that cisplatin at 1 mg per kg by itself, we found about 5.3 in the tumor. And when we put it into the dendrimer, it jumped up to 5x of that, 25. So what that means is we got more dendrimer into the tumor and overall kept the concentration the same. And it excretes rather well through the kidney because of the size. These are things that we begin to understand. Now, we can control the toxicity. We can, because of our ability to take and cover the surface of this dendrimer with all sorts of structures, you can see that here are the different surfaces. We've done with PEGs, we've done it with pyrrolidones, we've done it with sobel carboxylates. And down here are common benchmark excipients. And in many cases, we have a very similar profile, or in some cases, less toxic than some of the commercial excipients that are out there on the market today. Now, we have kind of an idea of our receptor-based mediated endocytosis as to how this works, and that is the dendrimer, once it comes through the bloodstream, approaches the plasma membrane of the cell, and then you can see our rather cartoon-like drawings of our folate receptors. Because they are floating in kind of an aqueous membrane, they move around. And as that dendrimer comes down with the folate there, the cancerous cells very early on say, we want folate because we want to start our process of dividing. And so they start arranging themselves to the dendrimer itself, and then they start to form a caveoli, okay, here, just an indentation in the cell. Then pretty soon you get this invagination. They literally grow right up around that, and an endocytose into the cell, okay. Once they're into the cell, they form an endosome. The pH changes. The drugs drop out. And then you get exocytosis and then excreted back through the urinary tract, if it's the right size. The dendrimer itself does not break down, doesn't metabolite. So it just acts as a carrier to deliver and drop the therapeutic. We find this, very interesting. But that's not the end of the road. If we can get this particular problem resolved, early diagnostic, followed with an ability to deliver the right therapeutics, okay, that's a huge step forward. But at the same time, we're also looking further down the road, 10 to 12 years, maybe 14, in terms of delivering siRNA, small interfering RNAs, to do protein silencing before the disease ever starts. And again, it's the same dendrimer complex that we're using in many of these cases. We can control the surface, the charge ratio. Here's some research that we've gotten with some of our new proprietary dendrimers. And the MEDKs is dog kidney cells, and you can see that we're good at much better than a lipid-based reagent, which is the market leader right now in this one cell line. Well, we're silencing at least almost 80%. And we think this is very early research, and we're very encouraged by what we're seeing. So the idea here is to take a dendrimer, deliver the siRNA, silence the protein's expression before it ever starts. Now we're not talking about an early diagnostic and a therapeutic, we're talking prevention. And I think this is what nanotechnology in medicine, this is the future direction. I think this is where it's going to ultimately wind up going. Now, where are we? One of the other messages I wanted to get out today was that this is not something that is 10 or 12 or 15 years out. We as a company, you know, we're kind of committed to the discovery and development and commercialization of our technology to help in the early diagnostic and prevention of human disease. That's kind of our, it's kind of what we do. But at the same time, I will tell you that we have a very significant royalty stream from Dendemer licensed technology that's already out there. Dade Behring has a cardiac marker that uses Dendemers as its foundation. That's one of them. We hope to be into, for a blood pool agent, into an IND status by the G4 of next year, 2006. So this isn't that far out. Our lead collaborator there, and I've heard some conversation today about the role of government. We are one of the first collaborators with the Nanotechnology Characterization Laboratory. And I don't know how many people have heard of that, but it's a new laboratory that was actually came out of conversations with NIST, the FDA, and the National Cancer Institute, where they sat down and they said, we're not sure that we understand all the protocols that will be necessary to do characterization at this level because the rules are different. We see different properties than what we've seen in small molecule drug. So they formed this nanocharacterization laboratory to do just that. And we are one of the first collaborators, our platform, and are currently working with them to characterize our work in the MRI contrast agent market. And then in the ovarian cancer area, we hope to have something up towards phase one clinicals by 2007, and then some of the other areas that I won't talk too much about, except that the very last issue, the Priostar Dendemer technology, this is one of the things that I think when you begin to think about nanotechnology and you begin to think about your products and you begin to think about moving them forward, okay, you have to have the ability to scale. You have to think about the manufacturing complexity and the cost. And I will tell you, a year ago when I went around and I started talking to the major pharmaceuticals, and we have research contracts with four different major large pharmaceuticals. I would say Dendemers. They'd say, oh, expensive commish. Great stuff, but way too expensive. So we went back and we reinvented ourselves off this new platform called Priostars, where we've taken the manufacturing complexity out, where it used to take 1 month per generation to develop. Now stop and think about that. I said for our MRI contrast agent therapeutic delivery, it was a G3 or G4. So we're talking 3 to 4 months to develop this thing at a cost of several thousand dollars per gram. Wonderful solution, never going to see the market. So we went back, and now we can make that same size Dendemer in less than 3 hours and several orders of magnitude cheaper. We're down into the cents and dollars per gram. That's what's going to take, I think, a concerted effort by all of us who are in this space to really think through how you're going to manufacture it and at what cost. That's an important message I think we need to get out. So that's who we are, and I think that's it. Questions?
I'm Steve Fowkes. I'd like to ask, are these dendrimers and what's in them stable enough in an aqueous environment that you could possibly look at them as a potential diagnostic tool for what they may be pulling out of the cell or coming out of the body with if you pull them out of urine, or is there too much exchange in urine to really look at that compartment?
No, they can act as scavengers. I mean, as they're hollow, they can collect things. We've been, for example, we know that they attract metals, especially heavy metals. But we've not done that research yet because we're just still focused on this area.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you see any nonspecific binding to red blood cells or other cells in the body?
Not to my knowledge, not yet, no.
Have you looked?
Yes. There is a technology out there that does bind to albumin, but we don't do that.
Two questions. One is, are you doing site-specific delivery of the dendrimers, both in the diagnostic mode and the therapeutic mode?
Yeah, you mean targeted?
Targeted.
Receptor-mediated targeted, yes.
No, I'm talking now on a physiological level. In other words, are you doing direct delivery to the ovaries as opposed to an injection and then free-floating in the bloodstream?
We have tried the IV approach, okay? We are talking with some medical schools about direct injection, but we've not tried that yet. Although I don't see why, once it got into that cranial, into the liquid surrounding the ovaries, that it wouldn't work.
So the other question is, you mentioned that the current market leader is a lipid-based.
For transfection reagents, yes.
Right, and you said that you were superior to that. Can you quantify that?
Well, I did up there. On one cell line, I can show you that. They had 19% silencing. We had 80. And, you know, I can go through several examples of those cells, but there are just thousands and thousands of cells. Some, I suppose that they might be better than us. But that's a lipid-based approach, and we're a polymer-based approach. They're two very different animals.
Thank you.
I have a question over here. You said that siRNA delivery would be 10 to 12 years away using your dendrimers. What's going to take so long? Is it the dendrimer technology, or is it just getting siRNAs to work better?
I think,
is it therapeutic?
Well, we're dealing with a very large pharmaceutical research group that are just beginning to look at that whole area. It is so new. And I think when you begin to talk about downregulation, that's an area that I think is going to take some while for acceptance at corporate levels and at FDA levels and other areas to move it forward. That's why I'm saying at least 10 to 12, because this is really pretty early stage research yet.
I have a question. In theory, why shouldn't this work for other cancers, specifically colon, rectal, which for both men and women?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that you're going to see this whole idea of targeted mediated delivery there. If you looked at that list, you've seen that colon, rectal, chloride, prostate, breast, all overexpress folate receptors, but at different levels. What we're looking for is that it seems like each type of cancer, and there's just, you know, lots of variations here, have their own kind of a marker system that once you begin to understand that, okay, now that's the beauty of the dendrimer. You know, we can take 3 to 4 folates, and that seems to be enough to attach, okay? But at the same time, we could put lots of other things on that surface, biologicals, if we find the right marker. But we're a small company, so... You know, we're kind of focused in on one that we think will have good success. And certainly, there is a huge need for.
On the basis of the high mortality rate of, for example, the ovarian cancer, isn't it possible to get on a fast track to actually get it into trials and use for all those people that are going to die anyway? They've got nothing to lose.
That's a possibility, but, you know, again, we're working with the National Cancer Institute on this and the FDA, and you got to get past a certain point of efficacy. I mean, we've not done enough animal tests, and my fear would be that, and I'm trying to remember the technology not too many years ago, Antisense where they went ahead and they injected it into some humans and they added a death, and it sent that whole technology back to the point that it's never recovered. And so I think there's a balance there, but there is a, you know, I mean, that there's a potential, but we're not ready for that yet. Well,
some of the drugs for HIV, for instance, have been on those kind of fast tracks.
That's right.
Exactly for the same mm-hmm. reason, that there's really a very low survival rate,
right.
and those people don't have any other
right.
treatments available, period.
Right.
So,
right.
But anyway,
well, we're really what we're really hoping to do is define the early diagnostic. That's really the big, you know, it's great that if we can cure it, but if you can find it quicker, the cure is so much better, and that's really what it's about. And that's what a lot of this whole nanotechnology area is about. It's that interface between chemistry and biology. What a special place.